hello, good afternoon. Sláinte, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, coming to you live once again from my cinder block empire here deep in the heart of Guelph at an unknown location. And joining me from also a somewhat unknown location, at least I assume so, is Adam A. Donaldson from... Adam, are you there? Are you on the line?
I am on the line.
Fantastico. That is wonderful. Today in the program, we're going to... Adam actually had an interview with our MP, Loy Longfeld, and they are talking about the issues of the day, both federal and beyond, I imagine. But before that, we are going to discuss the fires in the United States, which are not only affecting the most of the West Coast of America, but the entire continent and beyond. But before that, Adam, we had our first Canadian... a provincial pandemic election, as it was called, and probably the first of a few to come, I would imagine, in New Brunswick. And there was a bit of a redrawing of the seats down there, but finally the Progressive Conservatives of Blaine Higgs managed to get a majority and out of a minority situation. And I believe that was the result he was probably hoping for.
Yes, for sure. He, or I should say the PC's got 27 seats, which is two or three better. No, it's two better than they need for a majority. Yeah, and the Liberals were knocked down from 20 to about 17. The Greens stayed the same. All three of their MLAs were reelected. The People's Alliance, not to be confused with the People's Party.
Yes, that is confusing.
lost one of their seats. They went from three seats to two. But yeah, it's seen as sort of a disappointment for Liberals because they thought they had a really great chance with Kevin Vickers as the head of the party. Kevin Vickers, of course, was the master at arms the sergeant at arms on Parliament Hill the day of that terrorist attack, and he was the one who apparently shot the perpetrator. They really thought it was a slam dunk, but sadly for them, Blaine Higgs also thought it was a slam dunk, given the fact that he went from 50% approval to about 80% of approval during COVID. So, I've seen this repeated through a lot of commentators in the Maritimes, that he gambled on the idea that he had enough momentum to call a snap election and get a majority, and it turned out he was right.
Yeah, it's, I think under normal conditions, Kevin Vickers would have been a star candidate because he was, you know, heavily qualified. Not only, as you mentioned, was he the sergeant at arms on that day at Parliament Hill, but he was a diplomat and deeply involved in Liberal politics, I think, for a number of years. He wasn't a spring chicken, as we say. He didn't just show up as a like a parachute star. He ran in his home riding, which was the Miramichi. But he came up against some, what I would say, is populist strength. You mentioned the People's Alliance. He ran against a People's Alliance candidate there who had the seat. They went down from three seats to two, and one of the ones they did maintain was the one in the Miramichi.
His riding, yeah.
His own riding in the Miramichi. But that, her name escapes me, but the woman that ran was very much a populist and kind of entrenched in the community. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to unseat somebody like that who's involved. And of course, as we know, or as we've seen, the people that have seen the results know that the numbers-wise, it's a small province, so the returns are small as well. But it was interesting in the advanced polls, which went up a phenomenal amount, mostly probably due to COVID. It was 133,000 people voted in advance. Now, keep in mind that the PCs won with under 150,000 votes. So, I mean, that is a significant number. I think these are, in the scheme of New Brunswick, God, I almost said PEI. In the scheme of New Brunswick, those are big numbers. So it's interesting how many people took advantage of that. And I think that's probably the kind of thing we are going to see should other pandemic COVID elections take place in other provinces.
Well, to give you some idea, the PCs got 39.4%, the Liberals got 34.4%. So a difference of 5% means one party gets to you know, run the province unilaterally for 4 years, and the other party has to be the head of the opposition. But I mean, in the meantime, too, yet the Green Party with 15.4%, I believe their total vote share went up almost 4% between the last elections. But they had 15.4%, and the People's Alliance had just under 9%. So, you know, between them, they get a quarter of the vote, but they don't get a quarter of the seats. They get 5 seats between them. And it just, I think we're seeing more and more the visible frustration of lack of, what am I thinking about? Proportional representation. Uh-huh. You know, you have these smaller parties that, you know, are working really hard, getting rather big shares of the votes, but that is not represented in their final tallies. And yeah, it just that's another sort of recurring theme I noticed from some of the progressive commentators and bloggers and stuff from this election, is that, you know, the Green Party is going up. And that's actually another thing from the early voting, too, that was noticed. Because people were going to vote early, you didn't really have time to gain that momentum. And that's probably what hurt Vickers, too, because you know, you need time in a campaign for people to, you know, get to know you and get to know your stand on the issues. And with early voting starting so early, it was like less than 4 weeks of a campaign, or about a 4 week campaign. But the Greens were like building momentum, seeing their favorabilities go up. And then they call it on election night, and they only go up by a little. And it makes you wonder, like, how much more could they have done if this was a typical election where there was more voting on election day than all the early and mail-in voting we were seeing.
And of course, the ability to canvass and get your face out there. And that's been a serious detriment to a lot of people, because, I mean, in most places, but in particular in places like New Brunswick, you know, getting your face out there and becoming a known in the community, like I'd mentioned about the woman that won against Vickers. Once you're known, if you just show up as a fresh face, it doesn't matter really what your qualifications are. And that was the case with Vickers, in that, you know, he probably, I think in normalish circumstances, he would have done a lot better. And it sounded like the Greens, or at least the stats that I saw, just sort of the quick glance stats, the Greens seem to come in second in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, again, that's, I guess, with numbers being down and certain ones going up, but just tweaking it enough that the Greens went up, but the Conservative vote obviously went up enough for them to take the 27 seats. And I didn't realize that, I knew there was the kind of French-English divide in New Brunswick, but if you look at the map of it, it was kind of cleaved in two, and you could see there's the liberal north, which was the French area, let's call it, with the exception of the Green and People's votes here and there. And then to the south was, and you know, around the capital is Moncton. There's Conservative, or yeah, mostly PC vote down there. And I didn't know this guy, doing a bit of reading up about Higgs. At some point in his life, he was very anti-bilingualism, and I'm not sure if people know this. New Brunswick is, we think of Quebec as the French province, but New Brunswick is the only officially bilingual province. So the entire province is like, this is officially French and English. And that line has been, you know, subject to lots of debate. So it sounds like Higgs has softened quite a bit, because I did read somewhere that he's actually working on his French. So I guess if you've decided to keep the job, you probably should do that. So
I mean, he can't be working very hard if he's, you know, into his fifth or sixth year as the PC party leader, and he's kind of now working on his French. I mean, maybe that's what he's doing with his downtime and COVID, who knows, but
could be. He's on Duolingo like everybody else, right? Yeah.
I mean, it does, that's sort of one of the things you discover sort of digging down into the numbers, is that these little divides in the places where the Liberals won, which was, as you're pointing out, mostly in like kind of the north end of the province, the more Francophone centric areas of the province, they were decisive victories, where they were beating their nearest competition by like 10 times the number of votes the second place person get. In the southern parts, in the more Anglophone parts, they were sometimes losing in third place, fourth place. And you know, whether Higgs is still like fervently anti-bilingual or not, I think there's definitely a feeling that you have one party that is distinctly Anglophone and one party that is distinctly Francophone, even though I don't think Vickers, I'm not sure if he's Francophone, but the
I believe he's bilingual. I don't know. He's not Francophone.
He's bilingual, but yeah. But there's a definite feeling that maybe there is some hostility from the one side of the spectrum here. And the other thing, too, is that there was a divide inside the liberals themselves. There was one woman who ran for the Green Party who was the former president of a liberal writing association who quit because she felt that the party was undermining other potential leadership candidates in the last leadership campaign to make way for Vickers so they can make way for the star power of Vickers, which turned out to be not very powerful. But so there's some internal strife in the New Brunswick liberals too that is also exacerbating these like pre-existing language lines as well. It's kind of an interesting it's really an interesting case aside from all the stuff going on about, you know, voting and COVID and all that stuff. There are some pretty deep fault lines in these parties that are, you know, fortunately, they have 4 years, definitely 4 years to resolve them now. But it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Absolutely. And speaking of strife, the NDP are like virtually non-existent down there. I saw that Mackenzie Tomlinson, I guess he's the interim NDP leader, very young person, 100 votes. Like, that's the leader of a party down there, NDP. 100 votes. I was like, oh, my goodness. So, and in looking into it a bit, it seems that the NDP really haven't ever had a presence there. It sounds like they did under the CCF, but that's going way back in time. But they might have been along the lines of the People Alliance 50, 60 years ago, but now they're just not on the radar. And there was echoes of that during the federal election. Wasn't there? It was like Jagmeet didn't go, and they're like, oh, he didn't come, so we're just going to, you know. So they need to do a lot of work, I think, if they're going to be even on the radar down there, considering they're one of the top three federally and run other provinces as well. It's interesting to me that they're not really – things are just divided between the PCs, the Greens, and the Liberals with the
Less
Alliance.
Less than 2%.
Yeah. What's that?
Less than 2%.
That was the total vote.
Yeah, and that was from a record high of like about 13% in 2014, I think. So they've, I mean, that's
significant. Yeah, I didn't realize that. Yeah. So, yeah, and going back to the COVID angle, it sounds like things went okay. You know, the sanitizing of the Sharpies, and they had the procedure down. It looked like, from what I could see on the news, that people were keeping their distances and following the rules. So you'd hope something like that would carry over, because I heard a rumor on the socials before I got here, Adam, down into the bunker, that there might be a snap election in BC. Have you heard anything about that since this morning or no?
I haven't heard anything specifically lately. I know that there is some friction between the BCs, who are, of course, governing with the support of the Green Party. There are some in the Green caucus who feel like the BC NDP under Hogan maybe trying to, you know, shake things up so that they have to go to election. I mean, and that's the flip side of this too, is there was like 66% voter turnout, which is like only a loss of 1% from the 2018 election in New Brunswick. So almost everyone who came out last time came out this time, even though the potential dangers are greater. And I think people are concerned that other governments in other minority situations might follow in Blaine Higgs' example. It's like, well, if you're going to go and get your majority, this is the time. And of course, that could apply to Hogan in BC. It could, you know, even the federal level, Trudeau. There may be some out there who sense opportunity because of things.
The Greens have a new leader in BC too, right? And that may have changed the dynamic there. What's it, Sonia Furstenau?
Yep.
So, yeah, Andrew Weaver stepped aside. I guess he's sitting as an independent now. I'm not sure he's going to support, but I don't know if that'll affect the confidence in supply agreements. So there is a bit of rumbling there as well on top of the whole, you know, can Horgan get a majority? But it's the Greens that are propping them up. So if that prop falls out, then they'll definitely see an election. But it was weird because I saw a bit where it was like the new leader was sort of taking some shots at John Horgan, then the next day it was like, oh, it'd be really irresponsible to call an election in the middle of a pandemic. So it's a bit of a mixed message there within 24 hours. So I don't know how that's going to go, but that might be a topic for next week. We'll see.
Yeah.
But a topic that's on everybody's minds and ongoing is the fires down in Western USA. And this is unbelievable, Adam. It seems, from what I saw this afternoon, the smoke from the fires has not only reached Canada, which is giving us those beautiful yet kind of sad because they're beautiful sunsets. Smoke has reached Europe from these fires. This is like a giant, like completely out of control if it's gone that far. So I didn't really notice anything in the air, but it does seem sort of hazy, not terrible, because we've had smoke from forest fires up here before, but nothing like what they've seen in Vancouver. Isn't Vancouver had some of the worst air quality in the world, if not the worst air quality in the world, from the burning states of Washington State, Oregon, and California. And there doesn't seem to be any end in sight to this right now. It's just the whole place is alight.
Yeah, I think California had the worst air quality in the world yesterday, which is really saying something.
Because it's bad, at least in the cities, right?
Right. And typically, that's reserved for, you know, places in India and China where they have, you know, 15 million people in a city. Everyone's driving a car that hasn't been tuned since 1973. it's
a classic, you know, yeah.
It's surprising. One of the things I've noticed is I've seen a couple of people, and this is going on a bit broader, but I have seen a couple of people locally posting about this, that it's Antifa setting these fires, and that it's some kind of conspiracy, and you can tell because there are no wildfires north of the border of the United States, which turns out isn't exactly true. But I mean, it is fascinating to understand that actually, you have millions of acres on fire in 10 states. Canada is actually having a below average year in terms of wildfires. The 10-year average, it's typically by this point, we would have had 5,639 wildfires that had burned 2.9 million hectares, and this year it has been 3,621 wildfires, only burning 235,124 hectares. So we have seen a big dip in terms of the number of wildfires up here. Interestingly, it is being credited to the fact that in Alberta, when there's wildfires in Alberta, they're typically in the early part of the year, in the spring, between when the snow thaws and when blooming starts, and that period is typically very, very dry. Mm-hmm. And because the number of fires, between 65% and 70% of the wildfires in Alberta are caused by human activity, so humans going out and starting a campfire, other human activities, driving all-terrain vehicles in the woods, things like that. Mm-hmm. But because there was none of that in the spring this year because of COVID, the number of wildfires is way down because there was no human presence in the woods, or very little human presence in the woods this year.
The classic smoldering cigarette.
Right. Or just like leaving a fire pit and not putting it out properly and the embers catch and away it goes. But yeah, I found that very interesting to understand perhaps why we aren't seeing as much fire in Canada. That's not to say that there isn't fire in Canada. There are certainly wildfires going in Canada right now in the West Coast because, you know, climate change or the effects of climate change, no borders. But in the United States especially, it has been dry. It has been super hot. Like, there was 130 degree temperatures Fahrenheit, of course, 120, 130 degree Fahrenheit temperatures in California in July and August.
But it's going to get cooler.
Oh,
did you see that? I take it you saw that one on. I'm surprised that Trump sat down for a one-on-one like that, because he doesn't like being put on the spot. But there was the weird interplay between the those governing in California and Trump at the head of the table, just trying to bat down what they were saying about climate change and that. Well, science doesn't really know too much. And come on, dude. Like, he's painful to listen to at the best of times, but it's getting more painful, I think, when you hear stuff like that, when his theories.
I should note that there's the same day Joe Biden called Trump climate arsonist.
Arsonist, yeah. Good
and
line.
Biden said that before the little gathering in California where Trump said science doesn't know anything. So that was good. That was good counter messaging on Trump's part.
He's right on top of it. And Trump talking about the trees, the tree falls over and then it just explodes. I mean, he has no clue. He's just saying stuff, right? But really should listen to the scientists. But yeah, there is a lot of science behind what's going on. Of course, you mentioned the droughts and warming climate change. They also have a massive problem with what they call bark beetles, what we call pine beetles. Same kind of thing. There's insect populations growing mostly because of climate change, but also invasive species. And they did say that Trump, you know, there's a grain of truth what he was saying when he was blaming it all on forest management. There is this propensity, I guess, down in the States, but also in Canada too, particularly with farmed wood, in that it can't burn at all, which isn't how forests work. I mean, forests do work on controlled burning, at least certain types of forests. But when you have like a pine plantation, which is essentially a tree farm down there with trees spaced close together to maximize profits and whatnot, and add all those other factors that I mentioned, it's just like you might as well just... Well, I'm not because you might as well watch it burn, but of course it is burning. But you might as well just take a step back, because there's no way you'd be able to save it. And weirdly, I was reading about Scott Pruitt, who is probably the worst EPA guy they've ever had. I think he left under a cloud as well. But at one point, he said that, he had pushed the EPA to declare, and this was a few years ago, that the burning of wood was a carbon neutral process. So when you've got something like that on the books, or people, you know, pushing that point of view, it's when you have a case like this where it's like all of the wood is burning, then it isn't climate neutral at all. The factors that caused it are a climate problem, but also this will accelerate climate issues as well. Because what did you say the total was? It's more than 5 million acres, right? That are
right
burning.
Now, it is...
It's probably more than that since I wrote that down a couple days ago, right?
It's 2.9 million hectares. Oh, that's in... Sorry, that's in... Yeah, that's in the United States. 2.9... No, wait, that was... Sorry. I got my numbers mixed up.
That's
here.
Okay, and I can't make the conversion table. It's a hell of a lot of wood.
12.5 square kilometers is the size of the wildfire. That's in California alone, 12.5 square kilometers.
And Trump, again, was trying to dump on the state, saying, oh, it's, you know, state responsibility, it's the forester's responsibility, whoever's responsibility. It turns out that most of the wood, or the, what we would call crown land, the forests down there are 57% federally controlled and 3% state controlled. So it almost, it's not that it doesn't matter what the states are doing with that 3%. It's the fact that the majority control of these spaces and these forests is actually within the purview of the federal government. So it is within Trump.
I mean, that's true of most places in the United States west of the Mississippi. If you have a big open tract of land, chances are it's federally owned and by that federally protected.
Mm-hmm. But you were talking a bit about Biden calling him the climate... Was it the climate criminal?
Climate arsonist.
And of course, Biden used it as an opportunity to make a bunch of green pledges. I did see a bit of that. It was like electric vehicles, home efficiency, and getting rid of coal power. So, you know, taking the opportunity to take the exact opposite tack of what Trump was doing. But yeah, we were talking about the three states on the West Coast, but I think it's 13 states total are having fires. And since... I think it's since the 1970s. It hasn't, it's measurable how much is burned. And one stat said that this, from what they can tell, and this, again, this is going back to the science, that these are some of the hottest and largest fires they've seen in 300 to 400 years. Mm-hmm. And they can measure these things with tree rings and whatnot and whatever's going on in the soil, because the soil holds a lot of carbon as well. I mean, that's not eons, but in the scheme of things, in the scheme of, you know, it's even older than the settler America, right? And it's something that's been said too, is that they, you know, and ignoring the forest practices, not just of like sensible forestry, but of the indigenous peoples who probably contributed to the records and can tell people, or even tell, you know, address science and say, well, we know that in this period of time this had happened. Going back in time, I mean, you know, the indigenous people there lived with fire for hundreds and hundreds of years because, you know, they're reliant on the forest. So they had some fairly serious forest management skills. When you come in and upend all of that, then it's just a matter of time before an event like this happens and all those factors combine, so it just turns into a tinderbox.
Mm-hmm. There's been a 5-fold increase in annual burning in the annual area that suffers burning. The amount of area that has burned every year from forest fires has increased 5 times between 1972 and 2018. So in an almost 45-year span, they've seen a 500% increase basically in the amount of area that's burned every year in forest fires. And, you know, just speaking of carbon, you have this guy, David Legate, who basically was drummed out of the University of Delaware for being a climate change professor that doesn't believe in climate change. He's been appointed or he's been nominated to head the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Environmental Observation and Protection, a.k.a. the lead person at NOAA who oversees climate change research. So that's cool.
Yeah, it's always weird to me when somebody, a person of science, sort of makes these kinds of moves for political expediency. But then, yeah, that's a tough one. It's kind of like the doctors that are anti-maskers and that kind of thing. It's just a weird political thing. But who knows? Within 2 to 3 months, we may see a bit of a change in that. Mm-hmm. But considering we've got pandemics, hurricanes, fires, Trump. we have to hope for America that 2021 is a better year for them than 2020, because everybody just wants to shoot out the lights on this one, right? So
that's very positive and life affirming.
I guess so. On that note, maybe we should go to a bit of a break. Yeah. Man, sorry, I got to get out of the bunker more. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. We're heard every Thursday from 5 to 6. We're going to take a bit of a break for some station ID, among other things, and we will be back in short order, so stay tuned. Me, don't ask me if my name was Johnny Coolman. I say yes, man. They call me Johnny Coolman. Sick and stone can break my bone, and words don't bother me. Take it. Man, that's the unmistakable voice of Toots Hibbert. Toots Hibbert was supposedly the man who coined the actual word reggae. Passed away this past week at the age of 77, and presumably that was of COVID-19. That wasn't confirmed, but he was hospitalized with that. But anyway, Toots and the Maytals, definitely very influential band, and it's very sorry to hear that, but I'm a bit of a fan. And that song was called Johnny Cool Man. If anybody was cool, it was definitely Toots Hibbert. Speaking of cool, Adam, oh, you are still there. Good. that was the lead in there. You spoke to our MP Lloyd Longfield.
Yes, I did. We talk about what might be coming up next week in the throne speech, some COVID recovery stuff. And yes, we do talk about you know what.
Yikes.
So, yeah. So tuck in. It's going to be a good one, I think.
Okay.
Well, Lloyd Longfield, thank you so much for joining me today remotely.
Adam, it's great to be with you. As I was saying before we went on air, it's not the same as going to the second floor at the university with you and Scotty, but we all are making do as we need to.
Yes, we are. And I would concur that nothing is the same as the second floor. CFRU is our nirvana, and we hope to return soon.
I hope you're right.
So we're talking, by the time this airs, almost exactly 1 week from a speech from the throne. What's in it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm glad that you set the timeline on this, because whatever I say now, people will know more than what I know. We have been working furiously in the background since the throne speech was announced, and what I've been working on specifically has been around a national strategy for not-for-profits and charities. Looking at the community benefit organizations and how they've been really slammed in this COVID, as many businesses and organizations have, but they're particularly vulnerable because they're not able to do their normal fundraising, having events, and doing what they need to do to provide the benefits to the community right at the time when we need a benefit from, we need them to be here and strong and doing what they can do to help support the community. So we've been working in the background around how do we support the community benefit organizations through the federal government to deliver services to Guelph and other communities. So in the throne speech, if the words social innovation supercluster magically appear, then we have had quite a few conversations, hopefully getting that forward into the cabinet priorities.
Super innovation supercluster.
The social innovation supercluster.
Yeah.
We have superclusters for manufacturing. We have superclusters for digital, mostly economic-based superclusters. But we need to also look at social innovation, social financing, social benefit groups like we have in Guelph with the all the different charities that are supporting our community.
Yeah, I just to peel that back a little, when you're talking about a social... I can't even remember the term now, but when you're talking about that supercluster, what are we kind of looking at there in
yeah. terms? Well, locally, you'd look at an organization like 10C that is looking at delivering social or environmental benefits through their working with not-for-profits and organizations that are focused on setting up community gardens as a way to provide food for people that... that have trouble accessing nutritious, safe, affordable food. So social innovation is like any innovation. It's how do you do things differently? How do you do things in a way that is sustainable? And financially sustainable would be a piece that the federal government could help with, but also socially sustainable, environmentally sustainable. So the triple bottom line approach of building back better is very much on all of the Liberal MPs' plate right now, and have been working on this throughout COVID, where a lot of needs have really become amplified because of the people having to isolate themselves and maybe not having employment, or maybe having some challenges in different ways in terms of getting access to medications or food, or even socializing for seniors, being cooped up alone in a room where they used to be able to see their families. So social innovation is looking at how do we support society in new ways going forward based on the learning that we've had through COVID, and in fact, very much before COVID, for the last 25 or 30 years, we've had organizations in Canada working on social innovation, by and large without the assistance of government. But now they're also feeling the pinch. So if we were able to help them bridge back to financial sustainability. We don't want to lose them. We need them in our communities.
So how much of the conversation is about, you know, getting these groups through the hump of, you know, the COVID issues presently, and how much of it is about, like, not just addressing the issues coming out of COVID, but like those systemic issues you were talking about, the gaps in funding and support that sometimes go back decades?
Sure. Getting back to normal is not where we want to be. We want to be getting back to some better place that we are supporting each other better. What we've seen, as an example, we were able to get some funding to the County of Wellington. I think it was somewhere in the $500 million towards homelessness activities. So helping with shelters that need to buy extra PPE, or helping to relocate people into hotels instead of being on the streets, or into, if they're in a shelter with many people in the same room, how do we get them into more individualized care? And the point of that for me was, having worked on homelessness in Guelph for a number of years, is to say, whatever we're investing in, what long-term benefit can we get? Could we get some solutions using this money that will help during COVID, but then continue to help through next winter and beyond? And so working with the organizations that are focused on supportive housing, or the, let's say, the Women in Crisis, where women are in unsafe situations in their homes. They have to get into a shelter. There's no room in the shelter. There's nowhere else to put them. So they're stuck in a situation where they're not safe and cared for. So how do we get into the longer term solutions, using COVID as a springboard into something that's going to be better on the other side of COVID? And that's just one example. There's many, many in our community.
I think one of the longer term solutions that, well, at least that's coming before your caucus for consideration, basic universal income. Are you in support of setting up something that looks at to implementing UBI in Canada? And is there any sort of like hard information you can offer about, you know, maybe what would be involved in that from the discussions you've been having?
Yeah, there's, I mean, in 2018, now when everything of years, it's like yesterday was a year. Yeah. So let's get back and, okay, when did we actually do this work? We worked on a poverty reduction strategy, which is called Opportunity for All. And during COVID, I've been accessing that report a lot. Opportunity for All has a section on living with dignity, and part of that dignity includes income and financial support of people. So we did the CERB, launched it very quickly, within days instead of months or years, modified our EI system to be able to get money into people's bank accounts within days of them applying for the CERB benefit. We saw the immediate benefit of people getting into that support, which then said a lot of these people couldn't have accessed the previous EI system. So we are going through a revised EI discussion. The basic income is not a simple concept because of the involvement with provinces and territories on things like basic income or minimum wage. Of course, the Ontario government froze minimum wage. They cut off paid sick days. They eliminated the basic income project that the previous Liberal government had introduced. And pre-COVID, all of those supports, which are provincial supports, were taken away. So now for the federal government to implement a basic income program, knowing we have to work with the province of Ontario to deliver it, and also knowing the province of Ontario just torched everything that was done in the previous government, that's not going to be an easy challenge for us to deal with. So what other ways can we work on that, knowing that people need a basic income? So yes, I am working on it personally, and I've just given you some of the complexity of that, but actually doing the work of implementing it and actually doing the work of working with provinces and territories is far, far more difficult than just signing a petition and saying, let's fix that problem just with a stroke of a pen.
I think that's sort of lost in the translation in terms of getting a lot of this done. And I'm probably guilty of it myself sometimes, is that a lot of these big problems we have are not the exclusive responsibility of any one government to solve.
No, that's right. And you know, you're into politics in a big way. And of course, I am as well, funny thing. But the people that really just, you know, they are into politics in more of a normal way of just fix the problem and don't blame somebody else is generally what people think. But then you've got constitutional issues and you've got the legal issues. Jurisdictional issues. So we'd love to have a simple solution. We developed one for the CERB because we already did employment insurance and we knew a bunch of people were about to lose their jobs. It turns out 8 million people were accessing the CERB in the first month of it being out there. And a quick side story on that is that we brought people back from retirement. We worked with tech people in the private sector, people from Shopify, right? And from Ottawa, of course. And so we worked with private, public development. They developed a solution, tested it on 150 transactions and said, okay, let's go live tomorrow morning. And tomorrow morning meant 2 million transactions. 150 it worked on. And as it turned out, it pretty much worked on 2 million and then up to 8 million. But you can't just do that with everything because we have access because we do employment insurance, but we don't do ODSP. We don't do Ontario Works. We don't do what is normally given to provinces to work with municipalities to get localized solutions, because universal basic income in Quebec is going to be different than universal basic income in Alberta. And universal basic income in PEI is going to be different than universal basic income in Ontario. So we are working on the poverty reduction strategy of using the market basket of goods, which the market basket of goods measurement is localized so that real estate costs and the cost of a basket of groceries and the other utilities and whatever costs people face every month. We do have a localized market basket of goods. But delivering the support against that is really what we're now wrestling with as a federal government. Mm-hmm. And one of our delivery mechanisms that's worked is working with not-for-profits and charities. So we moved money into the United Way, we moved money into the Community Foundation and into the Red Cross, who then worked with the local organizations that were focused on eliminating poverty. And then I got reports back on who are you working with? And I was able to do a report to myself on, okay, they're working on food security, they're working on housing. I was able to break down the report so that I knew what parts of our community were getting supported through the United Way, Community Foundation, and Red Cross. Because now the federal government is at an arm's length. We don't know. We give the money to the organizations. So how do we get accountability and transparency into that loop? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, the We Charity was the example that, you know, hit the media and hit the news because of the transparency piece mostly. But we were working with the We Charity to try and get support to students, because we don't support students as directly as the provincial government does. So how else can we support students that can't get a summer job? If they could find a place to volunteer, we'll pay them for the summer job so they can get their tuition in the fall. And working with the not-for-profit in that situation became a problem because of the recusement and whatever else went on there.
Right.
And I'll also say, I mean, we are on the air and this is recorded. And you know, I had some personal concerns because I've been on 27 not-for-profit boards of directors in Guelph. Mm-hmm. And some of them are getting federal funding. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't have passed some of the tests as is. And so I've talked with the ethics department, and I've seen how do I test myself if I'm working on behalf of that. And what they've said to me is, well, would you support that organization if your key competitor in the last election was on the board of directors? And that's the question you ask yourself to make sure you're not being partisan in the way that you're supporting your community. Mm-hmm. And I was able to say to them, well, yeah, I already do support them because I am supporting an organization that I know that my competitor is on the board of directors. In fact, both my major competitors in Guelph, I've supported some organizations that they've been connected to. And they said, okay, that's fine. Those are the tests you have to do. And going forward, those are the tests we have to be more transparent about.
I think the difficult thing, and since you are very trained in your media management strategy, you brought up We First before I got a chance to. But I think that what concerns a lot of people is that from what you described, you seem to be thinking a lot about your own ethical entanglements more than people who are in cabinet. And I think what people are hoping for is that maybe there is some assurance that moving forward, they can trust the people who are in government cabinet, that they have learned the lessons from this, and that because I think, as we all understand, the appearance of a conflict is sometimes worse than the conflict itself.
Sure. And I'll also say that it's also easy to send something to the ethics commissioner if you want to cause a political scene of some sort, and then you can, without the report coming back, the news story is that so and so has had to go into a review by the ethics commissioner. So it's a political tool that is used, and it's just one of the tools that opposition parties always have, and the Liberal Party being no different. When we were in opposition, we would also look for ethical lapses. But more importantly for me is it makes me ask the question to myself would I be able to pass the test that the cabinet is also being asked to test? And your question to me was, shouldn't the cabinet be asking that question to themselves more frequently? Yeah. And they're all MPs as well, and we all have the public accountability and transparency. And so I would say, yes, every cabinet member should also have staff that are stopping them from doing things that are going to get them in trouble. Yeah. To say, you know what, you have to take an extra minute or two on this one. And I've got wonderful staff that have been involved with supporting MPs for one of my EA works with me, and I'm the third MP that she's worked with. So a few years ago I went to the Arctic, and when I went to the Arctic, it was on a climate change research discovery that I was going on. The lab was run by a person from Guelph, so I've got a reason as one of my constituents is up there, but I'm also working on climate change issues. And so that trip, I went through a lot of ethical type questions before I would go on the trip. My wife could have gone with me. We decided not to do that because she doesn't really have a connection, and there's no really connection to family work, although with her, we're a partnership, and we always we're both looked at by the ethics commissioner once a year, and our family is looked at. So they know where our daughters work, and they know any bank accounts we have, and they know any investments that we might have, or if I'm on the board of directors of any businesses, which I'm not anymore. So those are the questions that you want transparency on, and you definitely want the cabinet to be paying very close attention to the ethical requirements that we have to be nonpartisan and make sure that we're serving all people in Canada, not just the Liberal Party.
Right, because I think the idealized version of government people want in their heads is what you just described, where people are kind of hyper aware of where their ethical fault lines are. And it just feels like, you know, in the midst of this crisis where there was an enormous amount of goodwill about government action and people wanting to have that faith, that has been somewhat interrupted. And I would say it's not just the scandal, but it is also the proroguing of Parliament and kind of going for a reset in the midst of a situation where there was a lot of detail coming out about where those lapses were.
Yeah, and the proroguing, I mean, you and I have talked enough over the years. I think you probably understand that I'm not a partisan cheerleader. Mm-hmm. I am a member of the Liberal Party. I joined the party to run for office, and I'm serving the community that way. When you look at the proroguing, it was done during a period where Parliament wasn't sitting. And we will have lost 2 days worth of Parliament so that we can get the throne speech tabled on the Wednesday of the week instead of us going back to work on the Monday of the week. we were elected on a platform which much of which doesn't make sense right now because of the pandemic and what we're dealing with. So the commitments that we made during our campaign, some of them just don't make sense anymore because we have to focus efforts on the effects of the pandemic. None of us thought the pandemic was coming. None of us was prepared for the pandemic to hit us. When it did hit, I thought, well, okay, we might be away from the office for a little while. Now that little while means we're probably not going, I'm probably not going back to Ottawa this year. I'm probably not going back until the end of January. And I'm working on community issues that many of the issues I'm working on are as a result of COVID. So we need to reset the government agenda. And then we need to get Parliament to vote on that to say, well, do we have the will of Parliament to be doing the work that we are committing to do during the throne speech? And that can only be done by doing a throne speech, which you need to prorogue for at least a day in order for that to happen. Well, we've given ourselves some weeks for us all to work on what does life look like at the other side of COVID. And we've all been inputting our ideas into the Prime Minister's office so that he can present any ideas that they can pull together and say, here's a consensus. Basic income we're working on. Does that become an issue? How do we put that into a throne speech? Which minister is going to be working on it? How do we make that transparent in their mandate letters? And I heard on the radio this morning driving in that the provincial premier is fighting to not have mandate letters public, that he doesn't want people knowing what the mandate letter of each of his ministers is. Well, the Liberal Party has always put that out there. And in order to change mandate letters, you need a new mandate, not the one that we were elected on. So proroguing was, I think, done in exactly the way it should have been done. It wasn't to avoid a vote. It wasn't to avoid a confidence vote. It's actually to put a confidence vote on the table. Mm-hmm. And the Bloc Québécois had already signaled that they wanted a confidence vote. Mm-hmm. We're agreeing with that and saying, okay, we'll make it easy for you. Here's a throne speech, and then we'll see. And hopefully enough parliamentarians support our throne speech. If they don't, we're back into an election.
I'm keeping an eye on the time, so maybe just a quick answer on this one. If government survives the confidence motion after the throne speech, do we get a budget this year?
We'll get a fall economic statement. I don't think we'll see a budget until early next year. Typically, we do budgets in February. We missed the budget last year because of COVID. So we are operating in a bit of a void there. I don't think so. I think we'll see a fall economic statement instead of a budget.
All right. We'll take that answer. And Lloyd, thanks for the candor and all the answers today. And we will catch up again soon, maybe in person, but who the heck knows? As we know, there are a lot of unknowns, but we will stay in touch, and thanks for your time, Lloyd.
Thanks.
We'll meet again. Yes, wouldn't it be nice to be back in the University Center, Adam? Who knows? Maybe one of these days. You guys covered a lot of turf there.
Yeah, no. A lot of fun was had by all, even the uncomfortable parts.
Yeah, he handled that quite well, actually. Candid and candor is correct. So, once again, we are almost out of time. Adam, if mm-hmm. people want to find out more about you and what you do and where you go and what's a happening, where can they do that?
I can be found at Guelph Politico at guelphpolitico.ca. I'm on social media too at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram.
And I am Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and can be found in other places, but normally found here every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. here on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thank you so much for joining us. I believe we are on the rebroadcast now in the Friday morning slot for the drive time show, which is great. And we don't have to get up at whatever time to make that happen. But so join us when you can, and we will be back next week. Same time, same channel. So take care, folks, and we will talk to you soon. We'll be right back.